The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Caleb Wellum. Professor Caleb Wellum is a professor of history at the University of Toronto, and he's here to talk with us about a great book he published with Johns Hopkins University Press in 2023. The book is called Energizing Neoliberalism, the 1970s Energy Crisis and the Making of Modern America. Caleb, thank you very much for accepting our invitation.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
Before we start, can you please just briefly introduce yourself, tell us about your field of expertise, and more importantly, why you decided to write this book? What's the story of the inception of the book?
Sure. So, as you said, I'm a professor, assistant professor, on a contract, actually, at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, where I teach modern history. So I teach a lot of United States history, but also the history of capitalism, history of environmental thought and environmental politics. So I sort of think of myself as a cultural historian of environmental politics and environmental crisis, and a cultural historian of capitalism. And the United States is kind of my laboratory for thinking through those kinds of things. But often the United States in a global frame or context, and I think that might be a unique thing about this book, is that I'm actually from Canada. I'm not an American. And I did my PhD in Canada at the University of Toronto, St. George. So I think I take a slightly different view of U.S. history than you might normally get if you have, you know, an American working in American institutions writing U.S. history. It's a little more of an outsider's perspective. So the book began as a dissertation at the University of Toronto. But I first became interested in the energy crisis actually in 2008. So during the economic crisis of that period, the Great Recession, there was also a crisis or a concern about rising oil prices into the summer of 2008 in particular. And this was around the time of I didn't realize at the time, because I was just an undergraduate and master's student, that it was the revival or return of peak oil discourse. It's the first time I'd heard of the concept of peak oil, the idea that the world was imminently, quickly running out of oil, and this would cause some kind of social and political crisis. And so that kind of, those concerns were swirling around in 2008. The price crisis was swirling in 2008. I kind of heard about this thing called the energy crisis of the 1970s. And it seemed very interesting to me as something that I hadn't heard much about in a lot of the reading I'd done so far. And it seemed like not that many people had written about it. And it, as the more I learned about it, it seemed like 2008 was a different crisis, but had a lot of similarities, a lot of echoes, reverberations. And so I wanted to understand, you know, this previous crisis, could it teach us anything about how to respond to what was happening in the late 2000s. And so I began working on the book as a PhD student about 11 years ago.
Wow.
Which is crazy to think about. But when you're a PhD student, you're teaching, you're doing your comprehensive exams, et cetera. And then the revision process was quite long. The book, once I did finished the PhD, wrote a proposal, went through the peer review process, et cetera. It was kind of a long process, but I think it helped to refine some of the ideas that began kind of murkily in this PhD project into something a little sharper and more coherent.
Mm. You mentioned the 1970s oil shock, oil crisis, and I myself wasn't familiar with it until, I guess, 2010, 2012 or 2011, I heard the term oil shock, and I didn't know that Arab countries, for example, impose an embargo. But anyway, just for the briefly, maybe for the uninitiated, if you could tell us what the oil crisis of 1970s was, and then tell us how your book, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of research about oil crisis, but how does your book approach that topic differently?
Sure. Yeah. The 1970s oil, there were really two oil crises, one in 1973, 1974, and then another one in 1979, 1980. And these were periods of time when the United States was either formally embargoed from imports of oil from largely from Middle Eastern countries, or when they lost access to supplies of oil from Middle Eastern countries in the later crisis, the shock of 1979, 1980, which was related to the Iranian Revolution. So the first, so this was sort of a period when the United States was more heavily reliant on the import of oil to satisfy its growing oil demand than it is now, actually. And so in the 1960s, in 1960, a lot of oil-producing countries, which had kind of colonial relationships with Western oil companies, began to organize themselves and formed OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in 1960, which was this cartel that wanted to help these different countries coordinate their oil production policies in order to get better prices and to sort of have more control over the oil market than they felt they'd had before. And so this capacity developed in 1960, but the first time it was really successfully used was in 1973. And this is very resonant for what's happening right now in the Middle East. There was the Yom Kippur War between Israel and a coalition of Arab states, which were trying to recover land that they had lost in the 1967 Six-Day War. And the United States, as it has done, supported Israel in that conflict. And they were warned by certain Arab states that if they gave aid to Israel in the Yom Kippur War, they would face economic consequences. And so the Nixon administration went ahead with resupplying the Israeli military. And in retaliation, the Arab states of OPEC embargoed, stopped sending their oil to the United States, and also raised their prices of oil. So this led to a fairly quick price crisis where the price spiked overnight in October 1973. And as a result of the price crisis, it's hard to say if there were actual shortages, but there were shortages at gas stations, shortages of heating oil as the price went up, and you had sort of panic buying where people would top up their gasoline tanks because they weren't sure if there'd be enough oil the next day. So you'd get this kind of odd consumer behavior. So whether there were, whatever it means to say there were real or actual shortages, there were shortages sort of on the ground in different places. And this embargo lasted until March 1974. It was ended, but prices remained higher throughout the 1970s, part of a general inflation. There's lots of reasons, I'm sure, for that. And the concern that this first oil crisis had revealed the dependence and the vulnerability of the United States, their dependence on foreign oil and their vulnerability, therefore, to political interventions on the part of oil suppliers they didn't control. Then, under the Carter administration, 1979, the Iranian Revolution overthrows the Shah of Iran, who was the a staunch ally of the United States. Iran had been an ally of the U.S. throughout the 1970s. And in so doing, the U.S. lost access to Iranian oil exports, which was also a significant problem. Then you had the return of price spikes, the return of shortages, the return of this sort of second oil shock conversation happening. The OPEC, its ability to elevate prices was eroded in the 1980s. I was just actually listening today about the conflict happening right now in the Middle East, and especially around the United States and Britain bombing Yemen. And one of the arguments I've heard that the Houthis in Yemen have been making is that, why aren't Arab states embargoing the United States or Israel the way they would have done in the 1970s, which kind of suggests the ways in which the politics of that region, the geopolitics of oil has shifted for a variety of reasons. But yeah, so that's sort of a long-winded way of saying you have these two shocks, two moments of shortage and price spikes in this really important energy oil resource. So my book is about what makes it unique, I guess, is there's a fair number of accounts of the oil crises. You'll find books about them, or you know, larger works about the history and geopolitics of oil will have chapters and accounts of the oil crisis of the 1970s. And these are often oriented towards understanding geopolitical histories or economic histories of the United States, the Middle East, the global economy. Sometimes American electoral politics. There's an excellent book by Meg Jacobs called Panic at the Pump, which came out in 2016. And it's about sort of the role of the energy crisis, the oil crisis of the 70s in the ascendancy of conservatives and conservative political movements in the United States. My book, I think, is unique because it takes this cultural history, what I call a cultural history approach to understanding the energy crisis. And by that, I mean cultural history is an approach to history that focuses on not just the history of culture, but the history of meaning, and tries to, and the way people make meaning at different moments in time, and what the effects of those meanings are in the larger histories of those places. So I'm interested in, yes, the economic and geopolitical history of the oil crises, but it's always infused with this concern with the ways in which the energy crisis was debated, interpreted, and sort of mobilized in different ways, and these different cultural discourses, to use the academic term.
Thank you very much. That was a very, very good overview of what happened in the 1970s. And I think a couple of months ago, I came across something on Twitter. It was an interview, Milton Friedman asking for military involvement to stage a coup, with just a, you know, suggestion they threw around of some Arab countries to get back to oil. And mm-hmm. you mentioned cultural history. I really like that idea, cultural history of oil crisis. And so one of the most fascinating part of your book is how you talk about this idea of American lifestyle, this idea of the mass consumption before this energy crisis, and how this idea of American lifestyle was kind of promoted as a, let's say, a model or as an antidote to the communist lifestyle. And that sort of paved the way or had a role in that energy crisis. Can you talk about this part of the book, please?
Sure. Yeah, I felt like I had to give some kind of account of why it was. So I wanted to think about the importance, the impact of the energy crisis. That was the main goal. But then I had to give some kind of account of why it was in 1973 the United States would be vulnerable to this kind of disruption in supply, why it was consuming so much oil, so dependent on imported oil. And there are many reasons for that. And other people have written about the history of oil policy in the United States, which kind of ironically restricted the degree to which imports could come into the American market. It protected American oil producers because they didn't want to be undercut by cheap foreign oil. And this also actually had the effect of accelerating the depletion of more easily accessible oil resources in the United States. So that's one approach you can take. But I was trying to think culturally. I mean, the United States emerges in the post-World War II period as this just massive energy consumer. It's rare for a historian to commit to saying something is unprecedented, because we always like to find some kind of precedent or echo or similarity in the past. But this really was unprecedented, the degree of energy consumption that existed in the post-war U.S. I was trying to think about why that was, and there's lots of arguments out there about it. But one thing that hadn't been discussed before that I think is important was this effort to create a mass-consuming society to create a contrast to Soviet communism, as an antidote of sorts to Soviet communism. In the post-war period, America's ability to make consumption accessible to more and more people was taken to be a sign of its superiority as an economic system over against communism. So it's almost cliche to point to the 1959 kitchen debate. This lots of undergraduates know about the kitchen debate between Richard Nixon and Nikita Khrushchev, but that really is a great illustrative moment where you have the American president and the Soviet premier in a model American kitchen debating the relative merits of their systems. And Nixon is saying, you know, look at the technology, look at the access to consumption and energy that our system provides. This is a sign of our sort of superiority of our system. And the other thing is suburbanization in the post-war period. Suburbanization is a key part of post-war politics, post-war social and cultural life as more and more Americans move out to suburbs. Obviously not everyone, but a significant proportion of the country. And suburbanization, living in suburbs, you know, presupposes access to an automobile, presupposes access to all kinds of energy, to infrastructure, roads, gas stations, different materials. But suburbs were encouraged by the U.S. government. Also, as this kind of antidote to communism, there was a famous line in the 1950s that, you know, the private homeowner is too busy to be worried about communism. He's got too much to do. He has to mow the lawn and go to work to pay for the mortgage. He doesn't have time for those kinds of ideas, and isn't really interested because, you know, he's this independent homeowner. So in encouraging suburbanization and encouraging private homeownership as a way to inoculate the post-war American population to the potential lure of communism, in pursuing mass consumption as the kind of benefit of post-war capitalism, to me, I think there's a route there to the energy crisis, because you don't have an energy crisis if you don't have this mass consuming society. The other thing that's interesting about the United States is that it's often in this period in the 1970s imagined as this energy consumer, because it imported so much of its oil increasingly going into the 1970s, but it was actually still the world's, I think, second largest oil producer at the same time. So it was producing enormous amounts, but consuming so much more that it became dependent on other countries' energy resources that it didn't have control over, or didn't have as much control over as it would have liked to have.
And as you mentioned, so there was this, the fears of this kind of energy instability maybe resurface. And another part that was really, again, fascinating was Thomas Malthus. He said that the ideas of Thomas Malthus that resources and are limited for the population, kind of an apocalyptic vision again, came up again. How did it resurface, and how did it influence America's energy management system?
Yeah, so Malthus is interesting. He's this now controversial figure, a British reverend and demographer from the late 18th century, who, you know, made this argument that population will always grow faster than its resource base, and if you don't control population growth in a variety of ways, then nature will do the control for you through famine, through war, through disease, that sort of thing. What's interesting about Malthus is that those ideas, his ideas, had a lot of sway in Europe, but didn't really make a huge, enormous impact in America until the post-war era. And this is, again, part of thinking culturally about what prepared Americans to perceive the energy crisis in the ways that they did in the 1970s. So in post-war America, you have the emergence of, the evolution of conservationist thought into environmentalist thinking, and the emergence of environmentalism. And so Malthus is a part of that, I think, because in the post-war world, population growth began to accelerate, or continued to accelerate. And the United States was now in this moment of where it had self-consciously said it was going to take up the mantle of post-war leadership of the world. It was it was one of two superpowers in competition with the Soviet Union. I think in that role, you had a lot of intellectuals and experts and policy people and politicians seeing global population growth and becoming very concerned about the resource, the ability of the world to provide resources indefinitely if population continued to grow that way. So Malthusian kinds of thinking became part of environmentalist thought in the United States, culminating in the 1960s and 1970s with the idea of a population bomb, which an American scientist, Paul Ehrlich, had articulated this idea that the world was heading towards some kind of population collapse. So there's these kind of apocalyptic ideas circulating around that perhaps humans are consuming too much, and this is because there's too many humans, and you know, what is going to be the near and long-term future of our ability to access sufficient resources at these rates of growth, which is also interesting because it's part of this evolution. Early post-war environmentalism was actually concerned with abundance, too much pollution, too many chemicals, too many homes being built, you know, on ecologically sensitive land and whatnot. But it that concern with abundance begins to become a concern with scarcity around the figure of population. When there's an abundance of humans, then there's this fairly quick shift in the late 60s and early 70s to a concern with, oh, resource scarcity could be a problem as well.
You've given us a great overview of what was going on before 1970s in the United States in terms of consumption. And then also you told us what the oil crisis was. Now it's 1973, the oil embargo comes in and it impacts the economy. And there's this also shift from Keynesian liberalism towards a new liberal economy. So I'm interested in these ideas. How did this shift come about from, first of all, what is Keynesian liberalism and how did it shift to a neoliberal economy? And I myself, I'm really interested in environmental thought. I did parts of my PhD thesis on ecological humanities. So I had to read a lot about the history of environmentalism in the United States and you know, Rachel Springs, Silent Spring, Richard Carson. So can you tell us about how this economic shift from Keynesian liberalism came about and what was the role of environmental narratives or thoughts in this shift?
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, this is really, I find this interesting as well. I mean, obviously I put it in the book, so I must find it interesting. Part of what this book is arguing, it's called Energizing Neoliberalism. So I'm trying to account for the rise of a neoliberal way of governing societies, way of thinking about the world in the United States and North America, which may be under strain and stress in our current moment, but say 10 years ago, we would have said neoliberalism was the dominant sort of governing way of governing people and thinking about society. And so in order to account for its rise, I have to think about what came before and what did it displace. And I make an argument in the book that in the post-war period, Keynesian liberalism was the hegemonic or dominant sort of lens through which American policymakers, politicians, intellectuals, media people, sort of the expert class, the way they thought about and tried to govern the United States and other parts of the world. So Keynesian liberalism comes from the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, the British economist from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And essentially, it's a way of describing an approach to governance. It really, in the United States, became legitimized in the New Deal during the Great Depression, this idea that the government and its experts have a role to play and can actually manage the idea of like managing the economy through the production of statistics and expertise. You can kind of calibrate things so that there is a good amount of economic growth, there's a good amount of employment, and if things start to tilt one way or the other, you use the tools of policy, in particular deficit spending, where the government might start spending money to encourage people to spend so that you don't fall back into a depression. So it's really this optimism about the ability of governments to manage economies and to have really high levels of employment, high levels of growth. And it's always concerned about preventing a return to the Great Depression. You know, using the state to stimulate consumption, and that will stimulate production, and you won't get into these sort of economic depression cycles. Environmentalism, I think, is important for destabilizing or delegitimizing that paradigm. And this is, an argument that I haven't seen made in a lot of the things that have been written about the shift the kind of conservative or rightward shift in American political life, which a lot of historians have written about, seeing the 60s, 70s, and the 1980s, obviously with Reagan, as this key shift. And we always want to sort of point to obviously conservative figures and movements and forces. And so environmentalism sometimes gets a bit of a pass for that reason. But I think the role of environmentalism here is that Keynesian liberalism was really about encouraging, stimulating consumption. It's sort of legitimated, articulated during a depression when people are not able to consume as much, and it's about reflating the economy. When you come to the late 60s and 1970s, the concern of environmentalists is not to stimulate more consumption. It's about actually reducing consumption, especially reducing the consumption of energy. So environmentalism is this broader critique of a mass consumer society, which Keynesian liberalism was designed to cultivate and to sustain over time. I think that's one of the key points of tension between the two, is that environmentalism, at least in the 70s, environmentalists were saying we've created this mass consumption society that we are over consuming. We need to find ways to consume less. Keynesian liberalism wasn't really designed for that kind of a paradigm. But the other part of it is that, kind of ironically, I suppose, environmentalists and the neoliberals, or those interested in a shift towards more free market forms of governing society, deciding how resources are distributed and consumed, they kind of overlapped on this idea that we should turn to free market forms of pricing of energy to get people to consume less energy. So there was a significant part of sort of mainstream environmentalist thinkers who are arguing for a return to free markets in the form of decontrolling oil prices, letting oil prices go up so that people will consume less. I don't think environmentalists would often like to see themselves as complicit in the rise of a kind of neoliberal paradigm, but there it was in a lot of the stuff that I was reading from the late 70s. This kind of frustration that, you know, the U.S. throughout the period was really struggling to get its energy consumption under control. So what can we do? They came around on the idea of, well, we need much higher prices so that people simply cannot consume as much as they're accustomed to doing.
And as you mentioned, and I said it earlier, that I'm really interested in this environmental discourse. And it's quite interesting how, so the economists, let's say, they did want to do something about it, but at the same time, they weren't really serious about it. So they kind of shifted the discourse on individuals, the role of individuals and individual freedom. So what were the debates about the energy conservation ethics? And also, more importantly, that the role of individual freedom in these debates?
Yeah, so there was this interesting term I started seeing when I was reading stuff from the period, this idea of an energy conservation ethic is what the term was that would get used. You'd see television commercials about it. You would see government issued statements. You would see newspaper editorials saying we need an energy conservation ethic. And this was the idea that, well, one solution to the energy crisis, to this inflation of prices and this decline of supply, and the vulnerabilities that exist therein, is to just consume less energy. And so you would have environmentalists saying, yes, we should absolutely do that. People should, you know, learn to live differently, should change their habits. This is, you know, the idea of like turning the light switch off when you leave the room so you don't waste electricity. A lot of that kind of thing emerges out of the energy crisis or period. But there were more kind of neoliberal, market-oriented thinkers, and sort of not, I guess, non-environmentalists who would make the same argument, yes, we need an energy conservation ethic, but they weren't thinking as an environmentalist might that, you know, we want energy conservation so in the future we have this kind of low-impact, sustainable society. The argument on the other side, the non-environmentalist side, is that we need an energy conservation ethic in the short term because our consumption is a national security problem. It's a threat. It makes us vulnerable to these kinds of supply interruptions. So if we can just get our populations to use less energy in the short term, while also opening up, you know, the outer continental shelf of the United States to more oil development, while opening up Alaska to oil development, we can sort of buy time until we can produce enough energy in the form of oil, build more nuclear power plants, and then we'll have a high energy, but also secure, an energy secure society. So initially, there's this emphasis on both sides, though, on addressing individuals about their energy consumption, saying, you know, there's something every single citizen can do. Everyone has to make good decisions about their consumption, about how much light they use in their home. They have to insulate their homes. They should try to drive less, you know, take a staycation instead of a vacation, these kinds of things. So there was kind of an appeal to voluntarism because there was an understanding that there wouldn't really be an appetite, although there were discussions about implementing rationing, you know, gasoline ration cards and this kind of thing, and kind of a wartime scenario, there was an understanding there wouldn't really be a popular appetite for that sort of thing. So there were these appeals to voluntarism. But as that didn't really take hold, the shift then goes from voluntarism to, well, if we can raise the price of energy, that's a way of not having government tell people how much energy they can consume. We let individuals decide, you know, what their budget is for energy, and in that way we'll get consumption down. So I sort of call this like the neoliberal or the free market response. We'll just use the market to discipline how much people consume rather than asking them to discipline themselves, because, you know, a couple of years of voluntarist appeals revealed that it was very, very difficult to get people to consume less. And of course it would be, because for the previous 30 years, the country had been building a society that was organized in such a way that it was very difficult to reduce your energy consumption. If you rely on a car to get your groceries, and you live in a suburban ranch home that's hard to heat, I mean, it was a difficult ask for just individuals to just, well, just use less light, use less heat, don't drive as much. People didn't appreciate that very much.
And there was this campaign, and I, after reading about it in your book, I went out to check some of the videos, and I saw some of my favorite actors there. Don't be foolish, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us what that was?
Yeah, so there was this public service announcement campaign called Don't Be Foolish. So instead of foolish, it was fuel, don't be foolish. And it premiered during the Super Bowl of the mid-1970s, and you would have George C. Scott and, you know, the actor who was a Republican, and Don Shula, the Miami Dolphins football coach, and others basically addressing the American public, telling them, you have a choice. Your individual choices about using lights, and Don Shula's PSA, and he says there are lavish energy consumption. If you don't sort of discipline yourself in your consumption, then, you know, we're going to, this is, that's, your consumption becomes this kind of like national security threat of some kind. And these things are also drawing on deeper, I think, a deeper kind of Puritan Protestant heritage around self-discipline and delayed gratification. They're making those sort of appeals too, as if a lot of people's energy consumption was entirely, you know, entirely flexible, whereas they were sort of stuck in these a kind of just geographical way of organizing society that required them to use a lot of energy. So yeah, Don't Be Foolish is kind of a fun one. There was a later one, I forget the name of it, but Gregory Peck was in one in 1980, also telling Americans to, it was trying to be more positive during the Carter years. He was trying to say, like, keep it up, you know, we can keep reducing our energy consumption. But all these kinds of appeals were pretty much gone with the Reagan era. Reagan's optimism about consumption being good, having more power, more consumption, more optimism, more patriotism, you know, these kinds of appeals to doing less became politically very unpopular, as Jimmy Carter learned when he lost to Reagan pretty handily.
Well, I'm now intrigued kind of to find that Gregory Peck's commercial as well. But anyway, you So you did talk about voluntarism, that reliance on individuals, but then you go on to discuss how this market pricing discipline changed all those things. They kind of decided to ditch reliance on voluntarism and conservation ethics. What was that part of the story of energy crisis?
Yeah, I think what the book is trying to show is that there were different ways of perceiving and interpreting the energy crisis. So prices are higher for oil and other forms of energy. There are shortages, there are concerns, and it's always so in the near term, those are always serious things, but also a big part of the crisis is, well, what does this portend for the future as well? If it's this bad now, what's it going to look like in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? What does that mean for the American way of life? What does that mean for American global leadership? What does that mean in the Cold War? That's always sort of there. But so there's different ways of interpreting the crisis. And there was this, the initially this kind of dominant way that, you know, we consume too much. We need to consume less. Our society, our form of capitalism is unsustainable. So I call this kind of like an environmentalist interpretation. But there was always also another kind of interpretation that would say, yes, there's an energy crisis. There's not enough energy right now. But it's because governments have meddled with oil companies, with markets. They've overregulated things. And if we just liberate the companies and liberate markets, if we deregulate them, decontrol prices, then we'll eventually produce enough energy for our needs. We'll have energy abundance again in the future. And so I'm showing that that second interpretation is what ultimately wins by the early 1980s. And the turn to free market pricing, to decontrolling oil prices, to deregulating the oil production process. Because another context here is in the late 60s and early 70s, there have been a lot of environmental regulations placed on producers. And so oil companies were also very happy to say there's an energy crisis, and the only way to solve it is for environmentalists to lessen their demands on, you know, the kinds of things we need to be concerned about as producers, because our primary goal now should be producing more energy. So the I'm sort of making this convoluted, but the by the 1980s, it's this turn to the market. And so again, the idea is, well, the price will go up for a little while, and so people will consume less. And these higher prices will enable companies who are now less regulated, enable markets that are less regulated to go out to explore for more oil, to experiment and produce the energies that we need without government interference. And that's really kind of the ethos of the 1980s. A key part of the Reagan platform was this energy plan that he put out, which essentially said, we're going to liberate American, you know, entrepreneurialism and companies and individuals to solve the problem, as opposed to trying to regulate our way out of it. And to get people to just to feel bad about consuming too much, we're going to rely on markets to sort of distribute resources and get things going. So yeah, I think that's the kind of key shift, I guess, in just the interpretation of what the crisis means and how different people with different visions of the future use the crisis to argue for their particular view.
And do you think that the oil crisis and this transition towards using the market as a governance to sort of undermine democracy and the power of people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm very uncomfortable with, I mean, this book is a critique, I suppose, of a neoliberal paradigm. I'm uncomfortable with making everything a matter of the market and someone's ability to pay. And so, yeah, certainly, it certainly, especially in the Reagan era, was part of deepening inequalities, because then it becomes about, well, having high prices, well, people with more money are able to consume a lot more than poorer people. So there's certainly a way in which, you know, the neoliberal argument is that economic freedom is paramount, but in a free market society, you know, economic freedom is calibrated with how much wealth and access to money you have as well. So yeah, I think definitely there was an issue there, and also in sort of just the denigration of what governments and what the public and what people as collectives can accomplish as well. It was again very much about focusing on individual consumption, individual desires, as opposed to a broader collective sense of how, you know, we might rebuild or remake our societies and ourselves to be more sustainable or what have you.
Well, one of the reasons that I like this book is that it covers many different topics that I'm personally interested in. You talk about economy, talk about environmentalism. You also talk about cinema there. So you talk about American cinema in 1970s and how they depict this energy crisis and they were, and in ways that they were sympathetic to environmentalists. Can you provide an example of that? Please talk about how, what was the role of cinema in depicting this energy crisis there?
Yeah, I see cinema as a great, can be a great source for understanding, I think, just the cultural environment in which people are thinking through and interacting with things that are going on in their society. And so I wanted to look, so part of the argument of the book as well is that neoliberalism and the shift to neoliberalism wasn't merely, you know, an imposition of experts, that it was all, there was also kind of a populist element to neoliberalism. And so I wanted to look to cinema to understand sort of broader cultural interpretations and engagements with the energy crisis. How are people thinking about it? So initially, there were films that would that were kind of sympathetic, as you said, to the environmentalist position on oil and energy consumption, that would frame oil as a some kind of threat to the American to Americans, to the American nation. And so one really kind of fun film from the 1970s that does that is there was a King Kong remake starring Jeff Bridges, I think from 1975 or 1976. It was this big budget film, but it was this environmentalist take on King Kong. So Jeff Bridges plays some kind of environmentalist or environmental scientist. And it turns out that they find themselves on King Kong's island because they're looking for more oil. It's like an oil exploration mission. It's this oil and gas company called Petrox Petroleum, I think. And in the film, they end up taking King Kong back to New York City to be a mascot for the oil company. And so it's this film about the exploitation of nature. King Kong is a sympathetic figure in the film. And so the pursuit, the extraction of oil, the pursuit of oil, and the kind of greed that's imagined to be part of that process in that King Kong film was one way of thinking about oil as in this kind of negative environmentalist light. And there was another one. So the other one is the Robert Redford film of the 3 Days of the Condor, which was directed by Sidney Pollack. And that was a film that was framing oil as this kind of geopolitical threat to the United States. Robert Redford plays a CIA researcher in that film. And it ends on this note where the US government has become involved in all these dirty dealings in foreign countries in order to secure access to oil. But it's also this kind of critique of America, like they do that because we demand it of them. We demand oil to sustain our way of life. So there's, again, this sense of oil as this threat to America's self-conception or American self-conception as being this kind of good nation, when in reality their consumption, you know, ties them into all these kind of shady dealings that are part of the 3 Days of the Condor plot. So yeah, there's a number of kind of interesting engagements with oil.
I watched that movie, I think 10 years ago, but I never ever thought about it from an environmental perspective. I'm going to watch it again soon when I get the time.
Well, it's interesting because it kind of comes at the end. Like there's this conspiracy happening and it's revealed at the end. Oh, it's about oil. That's sort of the reveal, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Spoiler alert.
And I also do remember that maybe in 1960s, there were a lot of, not that I was born there, but anyway, I've seen lots of movies and I know that there were a lot of movies about the impacts of pesticide. There were huge insects or spiders walking into people's homes, which were, again, they did reflect this environmental ethics back then. And in your book, so you have this book, but you also talk about some of my favorite films, but unfortunately with the bad politics, so the car films and how they provide this, maybe it's a kind of contrast to those other films that you mentioned. They stress freedom, open roads, individualism. So can you talk about these movies as well, and also tell us how these movies connect automobile with the idea of mobility and political freedom.
So there's, you have the environmentalist films, like you said, in the 60s and into the 70s, they sometimes touch on oil or resources. But then there was this really interesting flowering, I guess, of car-centered movies in the 1970s. And some of them are really great. American Graffiti is a great film by George Lucas. And there are others. And some of them are really not great films, but they were very popular at the time. And I noticed that a lot of directors that people would recognize, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, of course, I'm not remembering the other names, but there were a bunch who did these films about car chases or people who drive cars for a living or car racing or truckers. So Sam Peckinpah, the once great Western director, directed The Awful Convoy. And so these films, I saw in them a response to the energy crisis, to the idea that Americans, because they often experience the energy crisis through the threat to people's ability to drive, insofar as they didn't have access to gasoline or they felt guilty for driving for a variety of reasons. And these films that kind of explore the automobile, explore the car, explore driving across the country, they often are about these kind of individualist figures and the ways in which they express their individualism and their freedom by their through their ability to drive and their ability to, kind of resist or rebel against authorities. And those authorities are always trying to restrict their movement, keep them from driving. So in Convoy is particularly interesting because in the energy crisis, in its politics, the independent truckers would often protest through slowdowns and convoys because they were arguing that their jobs are untenable with higher oil prices and with the speed limits that had been imposed to try to keep people from consuming as much gasoline. And so they became these kind of populist folk heroes standing up to the government and its regulations about how people could drive. And so in Convoy, you have Kris Kristofferson, country singer, film star, who plays this really cool independent trucker. And the whole film is about this self-organizing convoy of truckers that eventually comes to include a cross-section of Americans. And they're just convoying because they're upset about the state of their country. And the energy crisis is just one of many things. But being a trucker, being a driver, evading the sheriff who's always trying to keep you going the speed limit and stop you from driving as fast as you want, that's sort of central to the plot of that film and to a lot of others. Burt Reynolds's 1970s filmography, his most popular films like Smokey and the Bandit and Cannonball Run, are also about these kind of things. And so I was in the book, I argue that I think these films that kind of glory in automobility, so movement through automobiles, glory in speed, as opposed to government-imposed speed limits. I saw in them what I call this kind of petro-populist resistance or response to the idea of an energy conservation ethic. They kind of reject that idea. The environmentalist is often this kind of emasculated villain in a lot of these films, who's sort of finger-wagging at the all-American male who just wants to drive and be this kind of free, independent citizen. So I think in those, and a lot of critics, actually, if you read some of the film reviews and the various periodicals of the time, they kind of discerned this thing. There's this kind of like rightward populism in a lot of these films, and they're very popular films too, essentially arguing for driving and the freedom of the open road as an inheritance from the frontier. That's this kind of political right of American individualism. And so access to oil, consuming oil, goes along with that. Mm. And any attempt by the government to restrict or alter those patterns of consumption are taken to be, signs or examples of some kind of tyranny in the films in a variety of ways. But it's always done as kind of fun, like all these films are kind of fun and jokey, kind of hokey. So it's kind of interesting that way. I remember growing up, I also didn't grow up in the 70s, but I remember I saw them on TV in the 90s and didn't really, obviously wouldn't pick up on that context. But when you see them all together and try to think about them and what's happening in the 70s, to me, it becomes kind of clear. There's also a a kind of anxiety about the automobile and a kind of nostalgia about it. Like American Graffiti is very much wrapped up in this nostalgia for post-war car culture. I don't know that Lucas, that's not so much a petro-populist film as it is this kind of artifact of longing for a simpler time where consumption was a less politically fraught act, especially the consumption of the automobile. And it's a beautiful looking film too. So it was very, you know, it was a huge hit in 1973. There was a sequel that most people don't know about made in 1979. It was shown for quite a long time in the in 1973, 1974. So it becomes this kind of text that people can kind of gather around while things seem to be getting more complicated and falling apart.
And as you mentioned, any resistance to this movie would be considered maybe anti-American or even communist. It was a common label back then. And this movie perfectly represents new liberal ethics of consumption and individual freedom. And I guess being a cultural historian, it perfect makes perfect sense for you to talk about the movies at the end of the book as well, which I guess is the perfect ending to the book.
Thank you.
But before we come to the end of this conversation, I was wondering if there's any other project you're currently working on.
Yeah, so the book came out just a few months ago, but I already, you know, feel the pressure to get on the next one. So I am starting a project, which is going to be some kind of a history of the new economy. So this, the idea of an economy of computers and digital technology and information, but I want to have a kind of longer view history of the new economy. So this is the economy we're living with and watching unfold right now. But as I was doing research for this book, I found in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a lot of people starting to talk about, well, you know, computers, and a kind of information, a post-industrial economy, maybe that will be the way to solve the limits to growth that we seem to be butting up against in the 1970s with these different energy and environmental issues. And so what I'm working on is to think about, well, how are different energy imaginaries, so ways of thinking about how energy and society intersect, like even post-war ones around the possibilities of nuclear power, how might those have informed the construction of a new economy? How did the energy crisis inform the construction of a new economy? And in particular, the idea of innovation, technological innovation, as the sort of capitalism's way to exceed the limits to growth through different kinds of technologies. So that's kind of the main thing that I'm starting to think through. I'm also working on a second project, which is going to be about kind of a more a theory-oriented book around energy and history writing in general. And then I'm also part of a collective called the Petro Cultures Research Group. And so I've been co-organizing a series of meetings called After Oil 3. So we're co-writing a book right now that has come out of those meetings, which is going to be a kind of humanities-oriented critique or criticism of renewable energy, the way people talk about it, the way they imagine it, what they expect it to be able to do in the current moment. So it's historically informed, but it's also about the present as well. So that's kind of an exciting project that we hope to have out. That'll be out much sooner than the new economy book, I'm sure.
I'm looking forward to reading. And do you know which publisher is going to release these books?
I have an idea for the new economy one, but it's not finalized yet. And we have an idea also for this renewable energy one, but that's also not finalized. So I can't be clear yet.
Well, I hope to be able to talk to you soon again sometime, maybe towards the end of this year and early next year, to talk about your new books on New Books Network. Thank you very
That'd
much
be
for
great.
accepting this invitation.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure. I appreciate your interest.